handful.
That was your armor,
he said, and dropped the pieces with a clatter onto the rest at his feet.
And this is my knife. And since your helmet was no good to me, I'll have to fight without it. Are you ready, Bear? I think we're well matched. I could take off your head with one sweep of my knife, after all.
Utter stillness. The bear's black eyes glowed like pitch, and Will felt a drop of sweat trickle down his spine. Then the bear's head moved. He shook it and took a step backwards.
Too strong a weapon. I can't fight that. Boy, you win.
Will knew that a second later the people would cheer and hoot and whistle, so even before the bear had finished saying the word win, Will had begun to turn and call out to keep them quiet.
Now you must keep the bargain. Look after the wounded people and start repairing the buildings. Then let the boat tie up and refuel.
He knew that it would take a minute to translate that and let the message spread out among the watching townsfolk, and he knew, too, that the delay would prevent their relief and anger from bursting out as a net of sandbanks baffles and breaks up the flow of a river. The bear watched and saw what he was doing and why, and understood more fully than Will himself did what the boy had achieved. Will put the knife back in the rucksack, and he and the bear exchanged another glance, but a different kind this time. They approached, and behind them, as the bears began to dismantle their fire-thrower, the other two ships maneuvered their way to the quayside. On shore some of the people set about clearing up, but several more came crowding to see Will, curious about this boy and the power he had to command the bear. It was time for Will to become inconspicuous again. So he performed the magic that had deflected all kinds of curiosity away from his mother and kept them safe for years. Of course, it wasn't magic, but simply a way of behaving. He made himself quiet and dull-eyed and slow, and in under a minute he became less interesting, less attractive to human attention. The people simply became bored with this dull child and forgot him and turned away. But the bear's attention was not human, and he could see what was happening. And he knew it was yet another extraordinary power at Will's command. He came close and spoke quietly, in a voice that seemed to throb as deeply as the ship's engines.
What is your name?
Will Parry. Can you make another helmet?
Yes. What do you seek?
You're going up the river. I want to come with you. I'm going to the mountains, and this is the quickest way. Will you take me?
Yes. I want to see that knife.
I will only show it to a bear I can trust. There is one bear I've heard of who's trustworthy. He is the king of the bears, a good friend of the girl I'm going to the mountains to find. Her name is Lyra Silvertongue. The bear is called Yorick Birnison.
I am Yorick Birnison.
I know you are.
The boat was taking fuel on board. The rail cars were hauled alongside and tilted sideways to let coal thunder down the chutes into the hold, and the black dust rose high above them. Unnoticed by the townspeople, who were busy sweeping up glass and haggling over the price of the fuel, Will followed the Bear King up the gangway and aboard the ship. Chapter 9. Up River.
A shade upon the mind there passes, as when on noon a cloud the mighty sun encloses. Emily Dickinson.
Let me see the knife,
said Yorick Birnison.
I understand metal. Nothing made of iron or steel is a mystery to a bear. But I have never seen a knife like yours, and I would be glad to look at it closely.
Will and the Bear King were on the foredeck of the river steamer, in the warm rays of the setting sun, and the vessel was making swift progress upstream. There was plenty of fuel on board, there was food that Will could eat, and he and Yorick Birnison were taking their second measure of each other. They had taken the first already. Will held out the knife towards Yorick, handle first, and the bear took it from him delicately. His thumb claw opposed the four finger claws, letting him manipulate objects as skillfully as a human, and now he turned the knife this way and that, bringing it closely to his eyes, holding it to catch the light, testing the edge, the steel edge, on a piece of scrap iron.
This edge is the one you cut my armor with. The other is very strange. I cannot tell what it is, what it will do, how it was made. But I want to understand it. How did you come to possess it?
Will told him most of what had happened, leaving out only what concerned him alone. His mother, the man he killed, his father.
You fought for this and lost two fingers. Show me the wound.
Will held out his hand. Thanks to his father's ointment, the raw surfaces were healing well, but they were still very tender. The bear sniffed at them.
Blood moss, and something else I cannot identify. Who gave you that?
A man who told me what I should do with the knife. Then he died. He had some ointment in a horn box, and it cured my wound. The witches tried, but their spell didn't work.
And what did he tell you to do with the knife?
Said Yorick Birnison, handing it carefully back to Will.
To use it in a war on the side of Lord Asriel. But first I must rescue Lyra Silvertongue.
Then we shall help,
said the bear, and Will's heart leapt with pleasure. Over the next few days, Will learned why the bears were making this voyage into Central Asia, so far from their homeland. Since the catastrophe that had burst the worlds open, all the Arctic ice had begun to melt, and new and strange currents appeared in the water. Since the bears depended on ice and on the creatures who lived in the cold sea, they could see that they would soon starve if they stayed where they were, and being rational, they decided how they should respond. They would have to migrate to where there was snow and ice in plenty. They would go to the highest mountains, to the range that touched the sky, half a world away but unshakable, eternal, and deep in snow. From bears of the sea they would become bears of the mountains, for as long as it took the world to settle itself again.
So you're not making war?
Will said.
Our old enemies vanished with the seals and the walruses. If we meet new ones, we know how to fight.
I thought there was a great war coming that would involve everyone. Which side would you fight for in that case?
The side that gave advantage to the bears. What else? But I have some regard for a few among humans. One was a man who flew a balloon. He is dead. The other is the witch Serafina Pecola. The third is the child Lyra Silvertongue. First, I would do whatever serves the bears. Second, whatever serves the child or the witch, or avenges my dead comrade Lee Scoresby. That is why I will help you rescue Lyra Silvertongue from the abominable woman Coulter.
He told Will of how he and a few of his subjects had swum to the river mouth and paid for the charter of this vessel with gold, and hired the crew, and turned the draining of the Arctic to their own advantage by letting the river take them as far inland as it could. And as it had its source in the northern foothills of the very mountains they sought, and as Lyra was imprisoned there too, things had fallen out well so far. So time went past. During the day Will dozed on deck, resting, gathering strength, because he was exhausted in every part of his being. He watched as the scenery began to change, and the rolling steppe gave way to low grassy hills and then to higher land, with the occasional gorge or cataract, and still the boat steamed south. He talked to the captain and the crew, out of politeness, but lacking Lyra's instant ease with strangers, he found it difficult to think of much to say, and in any case they were little interested in him. This was only a job, and when it was over they would leave without a backward glance, and besides, they didn't much like the bears for all their gold. Will was a foreigner, and as long as he paid for his food, they cared little what he did. Besides, there was that strange demon of his which seemed so like a witch's. Sometimes it was there, and sometimes it seemed to have vanished. Superstitious, like many sailors, they were happy to leave him alone. Balthamos, for his part, kept quiet, too. Sometimes his grief would become too strong for him to put up with, and he'd leave the boat and fly high among the clouds, searching for any patch of light or taste of air, any shooting stars or pressure ridges that might remind him of experiences he had shared with Baruch. When he talked, at night in the dark of the little cabin Will slept in, it was only to report on how far they had gone, and how much further ahead the cave and the valley lay. Perhaps he thought Will had little sympathy, though if he'd sought it he would have found plenty. He became more and more curt and formal, though never sarcastic. He kept that promise, at least. As for Yorick, he examined the knife obsessively. He looked at it for hours, testing both edges, flexing it, holding it up to the light, touching it with his tongue, sniffing it, and even listening to the sound the air made as it flowed over the surface. Will had no fear for the knife, because Yorick was clearly a craftsman of the highest accomplishment. Nor for Yorick himself, because of the delicacy of movement in those mighty paws. Finally, Yorick came to Will and said,
"This other edge, it does something you have not told me about. What is it, and how does it work?"
"I can't show you here, because the boat is moving. As soon as we stop, I'll show you."
"I can think of it, but not understand what I am thinking. It is the strangest thing I have ever seen."
And he gave it back to Will, with a disconcerting, unreadable long stare out of his deep black eyes. The river by this time had changed colour, because it was meeting the remains of the first floodwaters that had swept down out of the Arctic. The convulsions had affected the earth differently in different places, Will saw. Village after village stood up to its roofs in water, and hundreds of dispossessed people tried to salvage what they could with rowboats and canoes. The earth must have sunk a little here, because the river broadened and slowed, and it was hard for the skipper to trace his true course through the wide and turbid streams. The air was hotter and the sun higher in the sky, and the bears found it hard to keep cool. Some of them swam alongside as the steamer made its way, tasting their native waters in this foreign land. But eventually the river narrowed and deepened again, and soon ahead of them began to rise the mountains of the great Central Asian plateau. Will saw a rim of white on the horizon one day, and watched as it grew and grew, separating itself into different peaks and ridges and passes between them, and so high that it seemed that they must be close at hand, only a few miles. But they were far off still. It was just that the mountains were immense, and with every hour that they came closer, they seemed yet more inconceivably high. Most of the bears had never seen mountains, apart from the cliffs on their own island of Svalbard, and fell silent as they looked up at the giant ramparts, still so far off.
"What will we hunt there, Yorick Bernison?"
said one.
"Are there seals in the mountains? How shall we live?" "There is snow and ice. We shall be comfortable. And there are wild creatures there in plenty. Our lives will be different for a while, but we shall survive, and when things return to what they should be, and the Arctic freezes once more, we shall still be alive to go back and claim it. If we had stayed there, we would have starved. Be prepared for strangeness and for new ways, my bears."
Eventually the steamer could sail no further, because at this point the riverbed had narrowed and become shallow. The skipper brought the vessel to a halt in a valley bottom that normally would have been carpeted with grass and mountain flowers, where the river would have meandered over gravel beds. But the valley was now a lake, and the captain insisted that he dared not go past it. Beyond this point, he explained, there would not be enough depth below the keel, even with the massive flood from the north. So they drew up to the edge of the valley, where an outcrop of rock formed a sort of jetty, and disembarked.
"Where are we now?"
said Will to the captain, whose English was limited. The captain found a tattered old map and jabbed at it with his pipe, saying,
"This valley here, we now. You take. Go on."
"Thank you, very much,"
Will said, and wondered if he ought to offer to pay. But the captain had turned away to supervise the unloading. Before long, all 30 or so bears and all their armor were on the narrow shore. The captain shouted an order, and the vessel began to turn ponderously against the current, maneuvering out into midstream and giving a blast on the whistle that echoed for a long time around the valley. Will sat on a rock, reading the map. If he was right, the valley where Lyra was captive, according to the angel, lay some way to the east and the south, and the best way there led through a pass called Sung Chen.
"Bears, mark this place," said Yorick Birnison to his subjects. "When the time comes for us to move back to the Arctic, we shall assemble here. Now go your ways, hunt, feed, and live. Do not make war. We are not here for war. If war threatens, I shall call for you."
The bears were solitary creatures for the most part, and they only came together in times of war or emergency. Now that they were at the edge of a land of snow, they were impatient to be off, each of them, exploring on their own.
"Come then, Will, and we shall find Lyra."
Will lifted his rucksack, and they set off. It was good walking for the first part of their journey. The sun was warm, but the pines and the rhododendrons kept the worst of the heat off their shoulders, and the air was fresh and clear. The ground was rocky, but the rocks were thick with moss and pine needles, and the slopes they climbed were not precipitous. Will found himself relishing the exercise. The days he had spent on the boat, the enforced rest, had built up his strength. When he had come across Yorick, he had been at the very last of it. He didn't know that, but the bear did. And as soon as they were alone, Will showed Yorick how the other edge of the knife worked. He opened a world where a tropical rainforest steamed and dripped, and where vapors laden with heavy scent drifted out into the thin mountain air. Yorick watched closely, and touched the edge of the window with his paw, and sniffed at it, and stepped through into the hot, moist air to look around in silence. The monkey shrieks and bird calls, the insect scrapings and frog croakings, and the incessant drip-drip of condensing moisture sounded very loud to Will, outside it. Then Yorick came back and watched Will close the window, and asked to see the knife again, peering so closely at the silver edge that Will thought he was in danger of cutting his eye. He examined it for a long time, and handed it back with hardly a word, only saying,
"I was right. I could not have fought this."
They moved on, speaking little, which suited them both. Yorick Birnison caught a gazelle and ate most of it, leaving the tender meat for Will to cook. And once they came to a village, and while Yorick waited in the forest, Will exchanged one of his gold coins for some flat, coarse bread and some dried fruit, and for boots of yak leather and a waistcoat of a kind of sheepskin, for it was becoming cold at night. He also managed to ask about the valley with the rainbows. Balthamos helped by assuming the form of a crow, like the demon of the man Will was speaking to. He made the passage of understanding easier between them, and Will got directions which were helpful and clear. It was another 3 days' walk. Well, they were getting there. And so were others. Lord Asriel's force, a squadron of gyropters and the Zeppelin fuel tanker, had reached the opening between the worlds, the breach in the sky above Svalbard. They had a very long way to go still, but they flew without pause except for essential maintenance. And the commander, the Afric King Ogunwe, kept in twice-daily touch with the basalt fortress. He had a Galivespian lodestone operator aboard his gyropter, and through him he was able to learn as quickly as Lord Asriel himself about what was going on elsewhere. The news was disconcerting. A little spy, the Lady Salmakia, had watched from the shadows as the two powerful arms of the church, the Consistorial Court of Discipline and the Society of the Work of the Holy Spirit, agreed to put their differences aside and pool their knowledge. The Society had a swifter and more skillful alethiometrist than Fra Pavel, and thanks to him, the Consistorial Court now knew exactly where Lyra was, and more. They knew that Lord Asriel had sent a force to rescue her. Wasting no time, the court commandeered a flight of Zeppelins, and that same day a battalion of the Swiss Guard began to embark aboard the Zeppelins waiting in the still air beside the Lake of Geneva. So each side was aware that the other was also making its way towards the cave in the mountains, and they both knew that whoever got there first would have the advantage, but there wasn't much in it. Lord Asriel's gyropters were faster than the Zeppelins of the Consistorial Court, but they had further to fly, and they were limited by the speed of their own Zeppelin tanker. And there was another consideration. Whoever seized Lyra first would have to fight their way out against the other force. It would be easier for the Consistorial Court, because they didn't have to consider getting Lyra away safely. They were flying there to kill her. The Zeppelin carrying the President of the Consistorial Court was carrying other passengers as well, unknown to him. The Chevalier Tialis had received a message on his lodestone resonator, ordering him and the Lady Salmakia to smuggle themselves aboard. When the Zeppelins arrived at the valley, he and the lady were to go ahead and make their way independently to the cave where Lyra was held, and protect her as well as they could until King Ogunwe's force arrived to rescue her. Her safety was to come above every other consideration. Getting themselves aboard the Zeppelin was hazardous for the spies, not least because of the equipment they had to carry. Apart from the lodestone resonator, the most important items were a pair of insect larvae and their food. When the adult insects emerged, they would be more like dragonflies than anything else, but they were not like any kind of dragonfly that the humans of Will's world, or Lyra's, would have seen before. They were very much larger, for one thing. The Galivespians bred these creatures carefully, and each clan's insects differed from the rest. The Chevalier Tialis' clan bred powerful red and yellow striped dragonflies with vigorous and brutal appetites, whereas the one the Lady Salmakia was nurturing would be a slender, fast-flying creature with an electric blue body and the power of glowing in the dark. Every spy was equipped with a number of these larvae, which, by feeding them carefully regulated amounts of oil and honey, they could either keep in suspended animation or bring rapidly to adulthood. Dialis and Salmakia had 36 hours, depending on the winds, to hatch these larvae now, because that was about the time the flight would take, and they needed the insects to emerge before the zeppelins landed. The Chevalier and his colleague found an overlooked space behind a bulkhead and made themselves as safe as they could while the vessel was loaded and fueled. And then the engines began to roar, shaking the light structure from end to end as the ground crew cast off and the 8 zeppelins rose into the night sky. Their kind would have regarded the comparison as a mortal insult, but they were able to conceal themselves at least as well as rats. From their hiding place, the Gallivespians could overhear a good deal, and they kept in hourly touch with Lord Roke, who was aboard King Ogunwe's gyropter. But there was one thing they couldn't learn any more about on the Zeppelin, because the President never spoke of it. And that was the matter of the assassin, Father Gomez, who had been absolved already of the sin he was going to commit if the consistorial court failed in their mission. Father Gomez was somewhere else, and no one was tracking him at all. Chapter 10 Wheels.
There ariseth a little cloud out of the sea, like a man's hand. The First Book of Kings.
Yeah,
said the red-haired girl in the garden of the deserted casino.
We seen her. Me and Paolo both seen her. She come through here days ago.
Father Gomez said,
And do you remember what she looked like?
She look hot,
said the little boy.
Sweaty in the face, all right?
How old does she seem to be?
About, I suppose maybe 40 or 50. We didn't see her close. She could be 30 maybe, but she was hot, like Paolo said. And she was carrying a big rucksack, much bigger than yours, this big.
Paolo whispered something to her, screwing up his eyes to look at the priest as he did so. The sun was bright in his face.
Yeah,
said the girl.
I know. The specters,
she said to Father Gomez.
She wasn't afraid of the specters at all. She just walked through the city and never worried a bit. I ain't never seen a grown-up do that before, all right? She looked like she didn't know about them even. Same as you,
she added, looking at him with a challenge in her eyes.
There's a lot I don't know.
The little boy plucked at her sleeve and whispered again.
Paolo says,
she told the priest,
he thinks you're going to get the knife back.
Father Gomez felt his skin bristle. He remembered the testimony of Fra Pavel in the inquiry at the consistorial court. This must be the knife he meant.
If I can, I shall. The knife comes from here, does it?
From the Torre degli Angeli,
said the girl, pointing at the square stone tower over the red-brown rooftops. It shimmered in the midday glare.
And the boy who stole it, he kill our brother Tullio. Oh, the specters got him all right. You want to kill that boy, that's okay. And the girl, she was a liar. She was as bad as him.
There was a girl, too,
said the priest, trying not to seem too interested.
Lying filth. We nearly killed them both. But then there came some women, flying women.
Witches.
Witches. And we couldn't fight them. They took them away, the girl and boy. We don't know where they went. But the woman, she came later. We thought maybe she got some kind of knife to keep the specters away, all right? And maybe you have, too,
she added, lifting her chin to stare at him boldly.
I have no knife, but I have a sacred task. Maybe that is protecting me against these specters.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, you want her, she went south, towards the mountains. We don't know where, but you ask anyone. They know if she go past, because there ain't no one like her in Chigazze. Not before and not now. She'd be easy to find.
Thank you, Angelica. Bless you, my children.
He shouldered his pack, left the garden, and set off through the hot, silent streets, satisfied. After 3 days in the company of the wheeled creatures, Mary Malone knew rather more about them, and they knew a great deal about her. That first morning they carried her for an hour or so along the basalt highway to a settlement by a river, and the journey was uncomfortable. She had nothing to hold on to, and the creature's back was hard. They sped along at a pace that frightened her, but the thunder of their wheels on the hard road and the beat of their scudding feet made her exhilarated enough to ignore the discomfort. And in the course of the ride she became more aware of the creature's physiology. Like the grazers' skeletons, theirs had a diamond-shaped frame with a limb at each of the corners. Sometime in the distant past, a line of ancestral creatures must have developed this structure and found it worked, just as generations of long-ago crawling things in Mary's world had developed the central spine. The basalt highway led gradually downwards, and after a while the slope increased so the creatures could freewheel. They tucked their side legs up and steered by leaning to one side or the other, and hurtled along at a speed Mary found terrifying, though she had to admit that the creature she was riding never gave her the slightest feeling of danger. If only she'd had something to hold on to, she would have enjoyed it. At the foot of the mile-long slope there was a stand of the great trees, and nearby a river meandered on the level grassy ground. Some way off, Mary saw a gleam that looked like a wider expanse of water, but she didn't spend long looking at that because the creatures were making for a settlement on the riverbank, and she was burning with curiosity to see it. There were 20 or 30 huts, roughly grouped in a circle, made of, she had to shade her eyes against the sun to see, wooden beams covered with a kind of wattle and daub mixture on the walls and thatch on the roofs. Other wheeled creatures were working, some repairing a roof, others hauling a net out of the river, others bringing brushwood for a fire. So they had language, and they had fire, and they had society. And about then she found an adjustment being made in her mind, as the word creatures became the word people. These beings weren't human, but they were people, she told herself. It's not them. They're us. They were quite close now, and seeing what was coming, some of the villagers looked up and called to each other to look. The party from the road slowed to a halt, and Mary clambered stiffly down, knowing that she would ache later on.
Thank you,
she said to her. Her what? Her steed? Her cycle? Both ideas were absurdly wrong for the bright-eyed amiability that stood beside her. She settled for friend. He raised his trunk and imitated her words.
Uncle,
he said, and again they laughed in high spirits. She took her rucksack from the other creature.
Uncle, uncle,
and walked with them off the basalt and onto the hard-packed earth of the village. And then her absorption truly began. In the next few days she learned so much that she felt like a child again, bewildered by school. What was more, the wheeled people seemed to be just as wonderstruck by her. Her hands, to begin with. They couldn't get enough of them. Their delicate trunks felt over every joint, searching out thumbs, knuckles, and fingernails, flexing them gently, and they watched with amazement as she picked up her rucksack, conveyed food to her mouth, scratched, combed her hair, washed. In return, they let her feel their trunks. They were infinitely flexible, and about as long as her arm, thicker where they joined the head, and quite powerful enough to crush her skull, she guessed. The two finger-like projections at the tip were capable of enormous force and great gentleness. The creatures seemed to be able to vary the tone of their skin on the underside, on their equivalent of fingertips, from a soft velvet to a solidity like wood. As a result, they could use them for both a delicate task, like milking a grazer, and the rough business of tearing and shaping branches. Little by little, Mary realized that their trunks were playing a part in communication, too. A movement of the trunk would modify the meaning of a sound, so the word that sounded like ch meant water when it was accompanied by a sweep of the trunk from left to right, rain when the trunk curled up at the tip, sadness when it curled under, and young shoots of grass when it made a quick flick to the left. As soon as she saw this, Mary imitated it, moving her arm as best she could in the same way, and when the creatures realized that she was beginning to talk to them, their delight was radiant. Once they had begun to talk, mostly in the wheeled people's language, although she managed to teach them a few words of English, they could say ankle and grass and tree and sky and river, and pronounce her name with a little difficulty, they progressed much more quickly. Their word for themselves as a people was Mulefa, but an individual was a Zalif. Mary thought there was a difference between the sounds for he Zalif and she Zalif, but it was too subtle for her to imitate easily. She began to write it all down and compile a dictionary. But before she let herself become truly absorbed, she took out her battered paperback and the yarrow stalks and asked the I Ching, "Should I be here doing this, or should I go on somewhere else and keep searching? The reply came, keeping still so that restlessness dissolves. Then, beyond the tumult, one can perceive the great laws. It went on. As a mountain keeps still within itself, thus a wise man does not permit his will to stray beyond his situation. That could hardly be clearer. She folded the stalks away and closed the book, and then realized that she'd drawn a circle of watching creatures around her. One said,
Question, permission, curious.
She said,
Please, look.
Very delicately their trunks moved, sorting through the stalks in the same counting movement she'd been making, or turning the pages of the book. One thing they were astonished by was the doubleness of her hands, by the fact that she could both hold the book and turn the pages at the same time. They loved to watch her lace her fingers together, or play the childhood game of this is the church and this is the steeple, or make that over and over thumb to opposite forefinger movement that was what Amma was using at exactly the same moment in Lyra's world, as a charm to keep evil spirits away. Once they had examined the yarrow stalks and the book, they folded the cloth over them carefully and put them with the book into her rucksack. She was happy and reassured by the message from ancient China, because it meant that what she wanted most to do was exactly, at that moment, what she should do. So she set herself to learning more about the Mulefa, with a cheerful heart. She learned that there were two sexes, and that they lived monogamously in couples. Their offspring had long childhoods, 10 years at least, growing very slowly, as far as she could interpret their explanation. There were 5 young ones in this settlement, one almost grown and the others somewhere in between, and being smaller than the adults, they could not manage the seed pod wheels. The children had to move as the grazers did, with all 4 feet on the ground, but for all their energy and adventurousness, skipping up to Mary and shying away, trying to clamber up tree trunks, floundering in the shallow water and so on, they seemed clumsy, as if they were in the wrong element. The speed and power and grace of the adults was startling by contrast, and Mary saw how much a growing youngster must long for the day when the wheels would fit. She watched the oldest child, one day, go quietly to the storehouse where a number of seed pods were kept, and try to fit his foreclaw into the central hole. But when he tried to stand up, he fell over at once, trapping himself, and the sound attracted an adult. The child struggled to get free, squeaking with anxiety, and Mary couldn't help laughing at the sight, at the indignant parent and the guilty child, who pulled himself out at the last minute and scampered away. The seed pod wheels were clearly of the utmost importance, and soon Mary began to see just how valuable they were. The Mulefa spent much of their time, to begin with, in maintaining their wheels. By deftly lifting and twisting the claw, they could slip it out of the hole, and then they used their trunks to examine the wheel all over, cleaning the rim, checking for cracks. The claw was formidably strong, a spur of horn or bone at right angles to the leg, and slightly curved so that the highest part in the middle bore the weight as it rested on the inside of the hole. Mary watched one day as a Zalif examined the hole in her front wheel, touching here and there, lifting her trunk up in the air and back again, as if sampling the scent. Mary remembered the oil she'd found on her fingers when she'd examined the first seed pod. With the Zalif's permission, she looked at her claw, and found the surface more smooth and slick than anything she'd felt on her world. Her fingers simply would not stay on the surface. The whole of the claw seemed impregnated with the faintly fragrant oil, and after she had seen a number of the villagers sampling, testing, checking the state of their wheels and their claws, she began to wonder which had come first, wheel or claw, rider or tree. Although, of course, there was a third element as well, and that was geology. Creatures could only use wheels on a world that provided them with natural highways. There must be some feature of the mineral content of these stone roads that made them run in ribbon-like lines over the vast savanna and be so resistant to weathering or cracking. Little by little, Mary came to see the way everything was linked together, and all of it, seemingly, managed by the Mulefa. They knew the location of every herd of grazers, every stand of wheel trees, every clump of sweet grass, and they knew every individual within the herds and every separate tree, and they discussed their well-being and their fate. On one occasion she saw the Mulefa cull a herd of grazers, selecting some individuals and herding them away from the rest, to dispatch them by breaking their necks with a wrench of a powerful trunk. Nothing was wasted. Holding flakes of razor-sharp stone in their trunks, the Mulefa skinned and gutted the animals within minutes, and then began a skillful butchery, separating out the offal and the tender meat and the tougher joints, trimming the fat, removing the horns and the hooves, and working so efficiently that Mary watched with the pleasure she felt at seeing anything done well. Soon strips of meat were hanging to dry in the sun, and others were packed in salt and wrapped in leaves. The skins were scraped clear of fat, which was set by for later use, and then laid to soak in pits of water filled with oak bark to tan. And the oldest child was playing with a set of horns, pretending to be a grazer, making the other children laugh. That evening there was fresh meat to eat, and Mary feasted well. In a similar way, the Mulefa knew where the best fish were to be had, and exactly when and where to lay their nets. Looking for something she could do, Mary went to the net makers and offered to help. When she saw how they worked, not on their own, but two by two, working their trunks together to tie a knot, she realized why they'd been so astonished by her hands, because, of course, she could tie knots on her own. At first she felt that this gave her an advantage. She needed no one else. And then she realized how it cut her off from others. Perhaps all human beings were like that. And from that time on, she used one hand to knot the fibers, sharing the task with a female Zalif who had become her particular friend, fingers and trunk moving in and out together. But of all the living things the Wheeled People managed, it was the seed pod trees that they took most care with. There were half a dozen groves within the area looked after by this group. There were others further away, but they were the responsibility of other groups. Each day a party went out to check on the well-being of the mighty trees and to harvest any fallen seed pods. It was clear what the Mulefa gained, but how did the trees benefit from this interchange? One day she saw. As she was riding along with the group, suddenly there was a loud crack, and everyone came to a halt, surrounding one individual whose wheel had split. Every group carried a spare or two with it, so the Zalif with the broken wheel was soon remounted, but the broken wheel itself was carefully wrapped in a cloth and taken back to the settlement. There they prized it open and took out all the seeds, flat pale ovals as big as Mary's little fingernail, and examined each one carefully. They explained that the seed pods needed the constant pounding they got on the hard roads if they were to crack at all, and also that the seeds were difficult to germinate. Without the Mulefa's attention, the trees would all die. Each species depended on the other, and furthermore, it was the oil that made it possible. It was hard to understand, but they seemed to be saying that the oil was the center of their thinking and feeling, that young ones didn't have the wisdom of their elders because they couldn't use the wheels, and thus could absorb no oil through their claws. And that was when Mary began to see the connection between the Mulefa and the question that had occupied the past few years of her life. But before she could examine it any further, and conversations with the Mulefa were long and complex because they loved qualifying and explaining and illustrating their arguments with dozens of examples, as if they'd forgotten nothing and everything they had ever known was available immediately for reference, the settlement was attacked. Mary was the first to see the attackers coming, though she didn't know what they were. It happened in mid-afternoon when she was helping repair the roof of a hut. The Mulefa only built one story high, because they were not climbers, but Mary was happy to clamber above the ground, and she could lay thatch and knot it in place with her two hands, once they had shown her the technique, much more quickly than they could. So she was braced against the rafters of a house, catching the bundles of reeds thrown up to her, and enjoying the cool breeze from the water that was tempering the heat of the sun, when her eye was caught by a flash of white. It came from that distant glitter she thought was the sea. She shaded her eyes and saw one, two, more, a fleet of tall white sails emerging out of the heat haze, some way off but making with a silent grace for the river mouth.
"Mary!"
called the Zalif from below.
"What are you seeing?"
She didn't know the word for sail or boat, so she said,
"Tall, white, many."
At once the Zalif gave a call of alarm, and everyone in earshot stopped work and sped to the center of the settlement, calling the young ones. Within a minute, all the Mulefa were ready to flee. Atal, her friend, called,
"Mary, Mary, come, Twalapi, Twalapi."
It had all happened so quickly that Mary had hardly moved. The white sails by this time had already entered the river, easily making headway against the current. Mary was impressed by the discipline of the sailors. They tacked so swiftly, the sails moving together like a flock of starlings, all changing direction simultaneously. And they were so beautiful, those snow-white, slender sails, bending and dipping and filling. There were 40 of them, at least, and they were coming upriver much more swiftly than she'd thought. But she saw no crew on board, and then she realized that they weren't boats at all. They were gigantic birds, and the sails were their wings, one fore and one aft, held upright and flexed and trimmed by the power of their own muscles. There was no time to stop and study them, because they had already reached the bank and were climbing out. They had necks like swans and beaks as long as her forearm. Their wings were twice as tall as she was, and she glanced back, frightened now, over her shoulder as she fled. They had powerful legs. No wonder they had moved so fast on the water. She ran hard after the Mulefa, who were calling her name as they streamed out of the settlement and onto the highway. She reached them just in time. Her friend Atal was waiting, and as Mary scrambled on her back, Atal beat the road with her feet, speeding away up the slope after her companions. The birds, who couldn't move as fast on land, soon gave up the chase and turned back to the settlement. They tore open the food stores, snarling and growling and tossing their great cruel beaks high as they swallowed the dried meat and all the preserved fruit and grain. Everything edible was gone in under a minute. And then the Tualapi found the wheel store and tried to smash open the great seed pods, but that was beyond them. Mary felt her friends tense with alarm all around her as they watched from the crest of the low hill and saw pod after pod hurled to the ground, kicked, rasped by the claws on the mighty legs. But of course no harm came to them from that. What worried the Mulefa was that several of them were pushed and shoved and nudged towards the water, where they floated heavily downstream towards the sea. Then the great snow-white birds set about demolishing everything they could see with brutal, raking blows of their feet and stabbing, smashing, shaking, tearing movements of their beaks. The Mulefa around her were murmuring, almost crooning with sorrow.
"I help,"
Mary said.
"We make again."
But the foul creatures hadn't finished yet. Holding their beautiful wings high, they squatted among the devastation and voided their bowels. The smell drifted up the slope with the breeze. Heaps and pools of green, black, brown, white dung lay among the broken beams, the scattered thatch. Then their clumsy movement on land giving them a swaggering strut, the birds went back to the water and sailed away downstream towards the sea. Only when the last white wing had vanished in the afternoon haze did the Mulefa ride down the highway again. They were full of sorrow and anger, but mainly they were powerfully anxious about the seed pod store. Out of the 15 pods that had been there, only 2 were left. The rest had been pushed into the water and lost. But there was a sandbank in the next bend of the river, and Mary thought she could spot a wheel that was caught there. So to the Mulefa's surprise and alarm, she took off her clothes, wound a length of cord around her waist, and swam across to it. On the sandbank she found not one but 5 of the precious wheels, and passing the cord through their softening centres, she swam heavily back, pulling them behind her. The Mulefa were full of gratitude. They never entered the water themselves, and only fished from the bank, taking care to keep their feet and wheels dry. Mary felt she had done something useful for them at last. Later that night, after a scanty meal of sweet roots, they told her why they had been so anxious about the wheels. There had once been a time when the seed pods were plentiful, and when the world was rich and full of life, and the Mulefa lived with their trees in perpetual joy. But something bad had happened many years ago. Some virtue had gone out of the world, because despite every effort and all the love and attention the Mulefa could give them, the wheel pod trees were dying. Chapter 11. The Dragonflies.
A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent. William Blake.
Amma climbed the path to the cave, bread and milk in the bag on her back, a heavy puzzlement in her heart. How in the world could she ever manage to reach the sleeping girl? She came to the rock where the woman had told her to leave the food. She put it down, but she didn't go straight home. She climbed a little further, up past the cave and through the thick rhododendrons, and further up still to where the trees thinned out and the rainbows began. There she and her demon played a game. They climbed up over the rock shelves and around the little green-white cataracts, past the whirlpools and through the spectrum-tinted spray, until her hair and her eyelids and his squirrel fur were beaded all over with a million tiny pearls of moisture. The game was to get to the top without wiping your eyes, despite the temptation, and soon the sunlight sparkled and fractured into red, yellow, green, blue, and all the colours in between. But she mustn't brush her hand across to see better until she got right to the top, or the game would be lost. Kulang, her demon, sprang to a rock near the top of the little waterfall, and she knew he'd turn at once to make sure she didn't brush the moisture off her eyelashes. Except that he didn't. Instead, he clung there, gazing forward. Amma wiped her eyes because the game was cancelled by the surprise her demon was feeling. As she pulled herself up to look over the edge, she gasped and fell still, because looking down at her was the face of a creature she had never seen before. A bear, but immense, terrifying, 4 times the size of the brown bears in the forest, and ivory white, with a black nose and black eyes and claws the length of daggers. He was only an arm's length away. She could see every separate hair on his head.
"Who's that?"
said the voice of a boy, and while Amma couldn't understand the words, she caught the sense easily enough. After a moment the boy appeared next to the bear, fierce-looking, with frowning eyes and a jutting jaw. And was that a demon beside him, bird-shaped? But such a strange bird, unlike any she'd seen before. It flew to Kulang and spoke briefly.
"Friends, we shan't hurt you."
The great white bear hadn't moved at all.
"Come up,"
said the boy, and again her demon made sense of it for her. Watching the bear with superstitious awe, Amma scrambled up beside the little waterfall and stood shyly on the rocks. Kulang became a butterfly and settled for a moment on her cheek, but left it to flutter around the other demon, who sat still on the boy's hand.
"Will,"
said the boy, pointing to himself. She responded,
"Amma."
Now that she could see him properly, she was frightened of the boy almost more than the bear. He had a horrible wound. 2 of his fingers were missing. She felt dizzy when she saw it. The bear turned away along the milky stream and lay down in the water as if to cool himself. The boy's demon took to the air and fluttered with Kulang among the rainbows, and slowly they began to understand each other. And what should they turn out to be looking for but a cave, with a girl asleep? The words tumbled out of her in response.
"I know where it is, and she's being kept asleep by a woman who says she is her mother. But no mother would be so cruel, would she? She makes her drink something to keep her asleep. But I have some herbs to make her wake up, if only I could get to her."
Will could only shake his head and wait for Balthamos to translate. It took more than a minute.
"Yorick,"
he called, and the bear lumbered along the bed of the stream, licking his chops, for he had just swallowed a fish.
"Yorick,"
Will said,
"this girl is saying she knows where Lyra is. I'll go with her to look while you stay here and watch."
Yorick Birnison, 4 square in the stream, nodded silently. Will hid his rucksack and buckled on the knife before clambering down through the rainbows with Amma. The mist that filled the air was icy. He had to brush his eyes and peer through the dazzle to see where it was safe to put his feet. When they reached the foot of the falls, Amma indicated that they should go carefully and make no noise, and Will walked behind her down the slope, between mossy rocks and great gnarled pine trunks, where the dappled light danced intensely green, and a billion tiny insects scraped and sang. Down they went, and further down, and still the sunlight followed them, deep into the valley, while overhead the branches tossed unceasingly in the bright sky. Then Amma halted. Will drew himself behind the massive bole of a cedar, and looked where she was pointing. Through a tangle of leaves and branches, he saw the side of a cliff, rising up to the right, and partway up.
"Mrs. Coulter,"
he whispered, and his heart was beating fast. The woman appeared from behind the rock and shook out a thick-leaved branch before dropping it and brushing her hands together. Had she been sweeping the floor? Her sleeves were rolled and her hair was bound up with a scarf. Will could never have imagined her looking so domestic. But then there was a flash of gold, and that vicious monkey appeared, leaping up to her shoulder. As if they suspected something, they looked all around, and suddenly Mrs. Coulter didn't look domestic at all. Amma was whispering urgently. She was afraid of the golden monkey demon. He liked to tear the wings off bats while they were still alive.
"Is there anyone else with her? No soldiers or anyone like that?"
Amma didn't know. She had never seen soldiers, but people did talk about strange and frightening men. Or they might be ghosts, seen on the mountainsides at night. But there had always been ghosts in the mountains, everyone knew that. So they might not have anything to do with the woman. Well, thought Will, If Lyra's in the cave and Mrs. Coulter doesn't leave it, I'll have to go and pay a call.
What is this drug you have? What do you have to do with it to wake her up?
Amma explained.
And where is it now?
In her home, she said, hidden away.
All right. Wait here and don't come near. When you see her, you mustn't say that you know me. You've never seen me or the bear. When do you next bring her food?
30 minutes before sunset, Amma's demon said.
Bring the medicine with you then,
said Will.
I'll meet you here.
She watched with great unease as he set off along the path. Surely he didn't believe what she had just told him about the monkey demon, or he wouldn't walk so recklessly up to the cave. Actually, Will felt very nervous. All his senses seemed to be clarified, so that he was aware of the tiniest insects drifting in the sun shafts and the rustle of every leaf and the movement of the clouds above, even though his eyes never left the cave mouth.
Balthamus,
he whispered, and the angel demon flew to his shoulder as a bright-eyed small bird with red wings.
Keep close to me and watch that monkey.
Then look to your right.
And Will saw a patch of golden light at the cave mouth that had a face and eyes and was watching them. They were no more than 20 paces away. He stood still and the golden monkey turned his head to look in the cave, said something, and turned back. Will felt for the knife handle and walked on. When he reached the cave, the woman was waiting for him. She was sitting at her ease in the little canvas chair, with a book on her lap, watching him calmly. She was wearing traveler's clothes of khaki, but so well were they cut and so graceful was her figure that they looked like the highest of high fashion, and the little spray of red blossom she'd pinned to her shirt front looked like the most elegant of jewels. Her hair shone and her dark eyes glittered, and her bare legs gleamed golden in the sunlight. She smiled. Will very nearly smiled in response, because he was so unused to the sweetness and gentleness a woman could put into a smile, and it unsettled him.
You're Will.
How do you know my name?
Lyra says it in her sleep.
Where is she?
Safe.
I want to see her.
Come on, then,
she said, and got to her feet, dropping the book on the chair. For the first time since coming into her presence, Will looked at the monkey demon. His fur was long and lustrous, each hair seeming to be made of pure gold, much finer than a human's, and his little face and hands were black. Will had last seen that face, contorted with hate, on the evening when he and Lyra stole the alethiometer back from Sir Charles Latram in the house in Oxford. The monkey had tried to tear at him with his teeth until Will had slashed left-right with the knife, forcing the demon backwards so he could close the window and shut them away in a different world. Will thought that nothing on earth would make him turn his back on that monkey now. But the bird-shaped Balthamos was watching closely, and Will stepped carefully over the floor of the cave and followed Mrs. Coulter to the little figure lying still in the shadows. And there she was, his dearest friend, asleep. So small she looked. He was amazed at how all the force and fire that was Lyra awake could look so gentle and mild when she was sleeping. At her neck Pantalaimon lay in his polecat shape, his fur glistening, and Lyra's hair lay damp across her forehead. He knelt down beside her and lifted the hair away. Her face was hot. Out of the corner of his eye, Will saw the golden monkey crouching to spring and set his hand on the knife. But Mrs. Coulter shook her head very slightly, and the monkey relaxed. Without seeming to, Will was memorizing the exact layout of the cave, the shape and size of every rock, the slope of the floor, the exact height of the ceiling above the sleeping girl. He would need to find his way through it in the dark, and this was the only chance he'd have to see it first.
So you see she's quite safe,
said Mrs. Coulter.
Why are you keeping her here? And why don't you let her wake up?
Let's sit down.
She didn't take the chair, but sat with him on the moss-covered rocks at the entrance to the cave. She sounded so kindly, and there was such sad wisdom in her eyes, that Will's mistrust deepened. He felt that every word she said was a lie, every action concealed a threat, and every smile was a mask of deceit. Well, he would have to deceive her in turn. He'd have to make her think he was harmless. He had successfully deceived every teacher and every police officer and every social worker and every neighbor who had ever taken an interest in him and his home. He'd been preparing for this all his life. Right, he thought. I can deal with you.
Would you like something to drink?
Said Mrs. Coulter.
I'll have some too. It's quite safe. Look.
She cut open some wrinkled brownish fruit and pressed the cloudy juice into two small beakers. She sipped one and offered the other to Will, who sipped too and found it fresh and sweet.
How did you find your way here?
It wasn't hard to follow you.
Evidently. Have you got Lyra's alethiometer?
Yes,
he said, and let her work out for herself whether or not he could read it.
And you've got a knife, I understand.
Sir Charles told you that, did he?
Sir Charles? Oh, Carlo, of course. Yes, he did. It sounds fascinating. May I see it?
No, of course not. Why are you keeping Lyra here?
Because I love her. I'm her mother. She's in appalling danger, and I won't let anything happen to her.
Danger? From what?
Well,
she said, and set her beaker down on the ground, leaning forward so that her hair swung down on either side of her face. When she sat up again, she tucked it back behind her ears with both hands, and Will smelled the fragrance of some scent she was wearing, combined with the fresh smell of her body, and he felt disturbed. If Mrs. Coulter saw his reaction, she didn't show it.
Look, Will, I don't know how you came to meet my daughter, and I don't know what you know already, and I certainly don't know if I can trust you. But equally, I'm tired of having to lie. So here it is. The truth. I found out that my daughter is in danger from the very people I used to belong to. From the church. Frankly, I think they want to kill her. So I found myself in a dilemma, you see. Obey the church, or save my daughter. And I was a faithful servant of the church, too. There was no one more zealous. I gave my life to it. I served it with a passion. But I had this daughter. I know I didn't look after her well when she was young. She was taken away from me and brought up by strangers. Perhaps that made it hard for her to trust me. But when she was growing up, I saw the danger that she was in, and three times now I've tried to save her from it. I've had to become a renegade and hide in this remote place. And I thought we were safe. But now to learn that you found us so easily, well, you can understand that worries me. The church won't be far behind, and they want to kill her, Will. They will not let her live.
Why? Why do they hate her so much?
Because of what they think she's going to do. I don't know what that is. I wish I did, because then I could keep her even more safe. But all I know is that they hate her. And they have no mercy. None.
She leaned forward, talking urgently and quietly and closely.
Why am I telling you this? Can I trust you? I think I have to. I can't escape any more. There's nowhere else to go. And if you're a friend of Lyra's, you might be my friend too. And I do need friends. I do need help. Everything's against me now. The church will destroy me too, as well as Lyra, if they find us. I'm alone, Will. Just me in a cave with my daughter, and all the forces of all the worlds are trying to track us down. And here you are, to show how easy it is to find us, apparently. What are you going to do, Will? What do you want?
Why are you keeping her asleep?
He said, stubbornly avoiding her questions.
Because what would happen if I let her wake? She'd run away at once, and she wouldn't last 5 days.
But why don't you explain it to her and give her the choice?
Do you think she'd listen? Do you think even if she listened, she'd believe me? She doesn't trust me. She hates me, Will, you must know that. She despises me. I don't know how to say it. I love her so much, I've given up everything I had. A great career, great happiness, position and wealth, everything. To come to this cave in the mountains and live on dry bread and sour fruit just so I can keep my daughter alive. And if to do that I have to keep her asleep, then so be it. But I must keep her alive. Wouldn't your mother do as much for you?
Will felt a jolt of shock and rage that Mrs. Coulter had dared to bring his own mother in to support her argument. Then the first shock was complicated by the thought that his mother, after all, had not protected him. He had had to protect her. Did Mrs. Coulter love Lyra more than Elaine Parry loved him? But that was unfair. His mother wasn't well. Either Mrs. Coulter did not know the boil of feelings that her simple words had lanced, or she was monstrously clever. Her beautiful eyes watched mildly as Will reddened and shifted uncomfortably. And for a moment Mrs. Coulter looked uncannily like her daughter.
But what are you going to do?
Well, I've seen Lyra now and she's alive. That's clear. And she's safe, I suppose. That's all I was going to do. So now I've done it, I can go and help Lord Asriel like I was supposed to.
That did surprise her a little, but she mastered it.
You don't mean... I thought you might help us. With the knife. I saw what you did at Sir Charles's house. You could make it safe.